Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Anthony Anderson, Democrat James Garrick, and Michael Miller from DePaul University in Chicago. Our program coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, the National Radio Hall of Fame Gallery. Nice to have you with us tonight. Phone lines open toll-free at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email comment, you can send it to btb@museum.tv. And if you missed the show and want to watch it again on the Internet, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com. And again, we archive all of our programs for you to watch at some point in the future. Nice to have you with us tonight. We're going to talk about a little bit about sort of the political week that was, a little bit about the Secret Service scandal, which is sort of dominating the news, although I don't know how much the general public can do about that. It is being investigative at the highest levels of government at the moment. And last week, we talked quite a bit about the potential security aspects of it, the breach in security when you're not keeping an eye on the job of protecting the president. And so I think an institution that really was without blemish suddenly has been cast into the front pages of newspapers all over the world for the indiscretions of a few, which has helped create quite a furor in Washington, D.C. There's also been, as it's obviously clear now, that Mitt Romney is going to be the Republican nominee. The whole game of who's likely to be his running mate has popped up, and we'll spend a little time talking about that, but not too much. We'll do a whole show on it in a couple of weeks. But Anthony Anderson, you are a card-carrying Republican tonight. People will remember when you were last here, you were touting, you were, I think, realizing that your original guy was not going to go very far, and he did not go very far.
Absolutely.
Very disappointed.
Well, I'm sort of disappointed at this point, but Rob, as you stated earlier, Romney's emerged as the candidate of choice for the Republican Party.
But your choice was Rick Perry to start.
My choice was Rick Perry to start. After Rick Perry, my second choice was actually Newt Gingrich. And I saw that he was going along the wayside in some of his statements and sort of this race started to become more about him than the race about the President of the United States.
Should he step down? One of the controversies is that he is still getting Secret Service protection, and really, I mean, there are more agents following him than
absolutely. It's time for Newt to get out the race at this point. Let the nominee Mitt Romney be the one to carry the banner for the Republican Party, and let the pieces fall where they may.
Jim Garrick again is our card carrying Democrat tonight, although neither of our guests are really carrying any official representation of the parties. But again, every 4 years we talk about who's going to be running for vice president, and we're going to go through several months of that this time, unless Romney pulls a surprise and names a running mate early, which I hope he does. Do vice presidents really mean anything?
If the president dies, it means a lot.
Yeah.
if they end up impeached and they resign, it means a lot. As a political balancing of a ticket, I think it's important. I think that if Mitt Romney chooses Colin Powell, his chances will escalate a little bit, but I don't think that's who he's going to name.
And Michael Miller from DePaul University, associate professor of economics. Again, does it mean anything who he picks?
I also agree that you want to hope that the president doesn't pass away, because that's the person you're really voting for. But I think that he's going to find somebody who gives him what he's not. I think Mitt is a very bright man, but he doesn't have much personality. No matter how hard he tries, he just doesn't seem. And we need somebody who has that personality, can balance the ticket both in terms of geography and votes and then in terms of personality.
Anybody that saw Marco Rubio on the television shows this morning, Candy Crowley, again, obviously more and more people are watching you know, what he looks like and what he has to say. But again, I think an odds-on favorite at this particular time. And I think, although in the past several months he has said, absolutely, I don't want to be vice president. No, no, no. You see Jeb Bush. I mean, clearly he left, I think, a rather significant opening by now deferring all possibilities and all speculation to this process that has been put in place by Governor Romney to select a running mate. So he really sort of a little bit not so deftly wiggled off the hook. But again, I think for those that were introduced to him today, I mean, very, very impressive, and someone that obviously would do obviously well in securing the state of Florida, which is important. But I think there is there's a debate out there as to what extent would he bring over Hispanic large numbers of Hispanics to the Republican ticket. Anthony?
Well, I think he can capture a lot of that Hispanic vote from the simple fact that Marco Rubio, he's articulate. He's impressive when he speaks about the country's issues. And so, yeah, I think Marco
and
Rubio
Cubans
can
Cubans are
the
different than Puerto Ricans
absolutely,
and different
absolutely.
From Mexicans. Right?
It's all Hispanic. It's all Hispanic.
It's all Hispanic, but within the Hispanic community, they don't view it that way.
Yes. You're absolutely right.
I have a lot of interaction with students from different ethnic backgrounds, and they're all considered Hispanic, but they are different. They have different things that are important to them and so forth.
So when the media, I mean, Candy Crowley, I think, who usually I think does a nice job, but I thought she was just so off base and just assuming that, again, the pontificating from the national media, well, you know, all the Hispanics, well, how are you going to get the Hispanic votes by only talking about Hispanic issues? It seems to me
strange.
You really
never
missed
understood.
The boat.
Exactly. The other thing about Rubio is he's such a young man. And if he's thinking only of himself, he should wait 4 or 8 years, and he'll still be in the Senate. I don't think there's going to be any problem with that. Mm-hmm. And he could be a shoo-in for president, in my opinion, but not right now. I think he is taking a chance. If he becomes a loser, if he and Mitt were to run and he loses, that will always follow him along.
Well, that's what I think. That's the reason why he's not actually running for VP, because I think he doesn't want to expend his capital just yet.
Yes,
he just wants to wait, and he's taking a wait-and-see approach as to what this election is going to come up. And, I mean, if you look at the candidate in Mitt Romney, I mean, a lot of people are saying, hey, this guy may not be the real thing, but if we're going to have somebody, you know, why should I expend my capital being in Rubio or Mitt Romney?
Jim, do you think, again, looking at it from across the aisle, does it look too much like a gimmick if Romney picks Rubio just as John McCain picks Sarah Palin, that it's more of a grandstand move as opposed to a politically well-thought-out plan?
I think the choice of the vice presidential candidate on the Republican side will be a marginal part of the issue. The issue in this election is going to be, do you support the Obama policies or do you oppose them? Do you want Obama to continue as president or don't you? Even if you renominated Sarah Palin, it's not going to make a big difference other than maybe she stopped looking at Russia from her backyard.
Yeah. But the other issue is the other name that's been mentioned is Governor Mitch Daniels has said absolutely definitely not today, and that didn't surprise anybody.
Nope.
But the other name that keeps popping up, at least in the first a few days here, is Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Ohio obviously is a very important state to
absolutely.
Carry. Not viewed as a very charismatic figure, mm-hmm. but again, strong Washington credentials, having worked for the Bush administration.
Yeah, if he could carry Ohio and Pennsylvania, I think is still up for grabs. That could be just what you need to tip it over the edge.
Would you agree that Santorum would not be a good?
He would not be a good choice. Not in my opinion.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about one aspect of life in the country. And if you are a fiscal conservative and you like to get bang for your buck, we're going to be talking about some things that may raise your eyebrows and perhaps your blood pressure. Back shortly. From Austin, Texas to Ashtabula, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. And Professor Miller from DePaul University, I'm going to ask a sort of a big, broad-based question. I want you to give us a little lesson in the economic woes that the country has. The economic woes are both national woes, and they're broken down by 50 states. I think all but a couple of states are in deep, deep trouble financially. Mm-hmm. And I want to put that in context with the broader discussion we will have this evening about the criminal justice system, about the percentage of people we incarcerate in this nation, whether it is a wise investment to continue down the road of incarceration and building prisons. That's basically is an integral part of certainly every state and to a lesser degree at the federal level. But how bad is the fiscal situation collectively for the nation? And what happens if we do nothing or continue to point fingers at the other opposite party and just keep battling about it without acting?
Well, there seem to be three time bombs which are set, one to go off late this year, at the end of this year, and then two over the next number, about a decade, are going to blow up in our face. And the first one is that on January 1st, unless Congress does something, it doesn't matter who becomes president, Congress has to do something about the massive increase in taxes that are going to occur on the 1st of January. Many economists I've talked to said, based upon these increases, they're unwilling to make forecasts for GDP next year because they're convinced that if they all go into effect, we'll probably push ourselves back into a recession. The two longer-term ones, one would be, for example, at the state level, we have these enormous promises regarding retirement. We have made promise after promise after promise, and we've not put any money aside. Anytime the state of Illinois, which is broke, has made promises, they make the contributions by borrowing the money in the first place. So there's really no money there. And at the national level, the time bomb to go off is Medicare. We have around this room, a couple of us are probably either in it or soon to enter Medicare as a fringe benefit from being an American. And a number of us who are retiring is going to be so overwhelming to the system that without something being done, it's going to bankrupt the country.
If we were to look at try to break the fiscal problems of the country down, do you believe there's problems of revenue generation and there's problems of too much waste?
Mm-hmm. I think there is a problem mainly of waste, and it's just that demographics is our problem with the baby boom coming and then with the fact that they've made these promises for the retirements. But in terms of revenue, one point that I've been pushing is that if you go right before the onset of the big recession we just had, the deficit we had in the economy was 1.5% of GDP. Under the current tax rates, under what are called the Bush tax cuts. Some people are arguing we need to have more revenue, and the only way to do that is to raise rates. No, what we need are more people working. If you take the current rates as they are right now, leave them in force through 2013 and 2014, if people are working in the same ways as they were at the time of the onset of the big recession, we'll have plenty of revenues. Because the government just cannot, over time, bring in more than about 18.5% of GDP in revenue. Anytime they try to raise rates to bring in more money, people simply do what they have to avoid paying those taxes.
At the state level in a variety of states, including here in Illinois, where our broadcast originates from, governors frequently, when they're looking at where to cut, one of the fastest growing areas at all states is the growth of prisons in many states. And they look to the prisons as a place to cut either early releases or a variety of other opportunities, or in some cases, to a lesser extent, you know, alternatives to incarceration. Jim Garrick, this subject of incarceration is very near and dear to your heart, specifically as it relates to legalization of marijuana, lessening of the enforcement of drug laws in the country, because the prisons are filled with people who are violators of the drug laws. To what extent, in your view, is this an issue that should be looked at as an economic issue more than one of justice?
Well, the economics are critical. During the 1990s, because of the war on drugs, the fastest growing housing in the United States was prisons. We've built prisons to the point where 48 out of 50 states are in the red, can't pay their bills. California has 170,000 inmates, and the conditions are so bad that the Supreme Court has said get rid of 30,000 of them. Here in Illinois, we've got 50,000 prisoners. In Wisconsin, they have 22,000 prisoners. Minnesota has like about a third of what they have in Wisconsin. So when I give speeches in Wisconsin about the drug war, I say, is it really true that you Wisconsinites are 2.5 times worse than Minnesotaites? It's a joke. It depends on what we do with this crazy war on drugs. We put prohibition in place to save ourselves and our kids from drugs and trying to protect society. And instead, what we've done, number one, is we've put more drugs uncontrolled and regulated everywhere. And even worse, we have created a whole litany of problems, each which comes with the price tag. When you have the kids quitting school to join a gang, getting a gun, shooting each other, putting bullet holes in them, and nobody to pay for the medical bills because they're in an uninsured occupation, then the bill for the bullet holes goes to the public. When somebody shoots somebody, you have to put them in jail because of the violence. So now we've got to pay for the prisons. In the 1990s, I advocated no new prisons. Instead, the people elected someone else, and we ended up with a new prison every year. We increased the population of the Cook County Jail, as an example, from 9,000 to 10,000 capacity in the early 90s. In order to do that, we had to double the bonded indebtedness of Cook County.
But what is the option? I want to get Anthony involved in this because, Anthony, you're involved with the Republican Precinct Project, which has brought you to the show in the past, but you're also in the juvenile justice system.
Absolutely.
And you've been there for 19 years. When you hear someone say that they want to perhaps legalize marijuana or some drugs or decriminalize, what is your reaction as a professional?
My reaction to that is absolutely not. I mean, I would like to see, you know, decriminalization on certain aspects of the drug war, but to just abject saying, you know what, we're going to stop making drugs in this country available to gangs and all this other stuff. We're going to stop building prisons. The reason why we have this prison industrial complex is because we have individuals out there that are prone to breaking the law. Facts. I mean, we wouldn't build prisons in Illinois and Cook County and all over the country if we didn't have people that abided by the law. And by that, you know, you're going to always have individuals selling drugs on the streets. You're going to always have individuals breaking laws. So what do you do with those individuals? Are we going to have a country without walls in terms of prisons?
But is there a way at this point with the new technologies, is there a way that if someone violates the law – and society has said that that person should be punished, that there is a viable alternative to sending them to a prison for 3 to 5 years using some new technologies,
well,
Professor?
Do you,
from an economic standpoint,
yeah, the one thing about the war on drugs and looking at it purely as an economist as opposed to these guys who are experts in the field, all the way back to the work of Milton Friedman several decades ago, he was just trying to figure out, is the war on drug worth it? Or should we just let adults put into their bodies whatever they want and they have to suffer the consequences? But once you try to regulate their drugs, you create a market, a black market, where people can sell and make huge profits. And so if you would remove that profit, if you would legalize some of these drugs, those things would simply disappear. There wouldn't be that particular violence. No.
And in most cases, I mean, if you look at some of the drug dealers in this country, most of them are pretty much violent offenders. I mean,
they're
violent people.
I have to intercede here. There is such a huge difference between someone engaging in a consensual transaction to buy and sell drugs. That is not a violent transaction. Any more than the buying or selling of alcohol is a violent transaction.
But what
happens is when we put prohibition in place, we recreate the Al Capone United Nations paradigm on drug policy, where we tempt kids by putting a pot of gold next to the choice we tell them not to take, where now they're joining gangs, shooting each other, fighting over who's going to control the most valuable commodity on the face of the earth, something that grows on a plant that has no value as a marijuana plant, a cocoa plant, a poppy plant, until you prohibit it and you tell people they can't have them. Now, I took the price of heroin out of a graph from the drug czar's office to compare the price of it to gold. The price of heroin was plummeting. The purity was increasing, according to the drug czar's office, and yet when I compared the price and made the weight the same unit of measure, the heroin was 200 times more valuable than gold by weight. So you wonder why these kids are doing the wrong thing. It's because we put in place a policy that puts more drugs everywhere. When I was a prosecutor in the early 70s, the best heroin you could get in Chicago was 2% pure. Now, after 40 years of drug war, you can get 90% pure heroin on the West Side with high school kids. The high schools in the area where I live, they got heroin. I was giving a speech last week at the Rotary Club in Kenosha, Wisconsin. That I met the funeral home director on the way in. He said, "We got two kids laying in my lab from nice families that are dead from overdoses on heroin." And he says, "We got two more in the morgue that we can't identify." Then I go to the chief of police, Morrissey, for the town, and I says, is it really as bad as you said about the heroin? He says, we have one heroin overdose a day, not death, but overdose, in a town of 100,000 people. We have put drugs. I was down in Mexico City in the month of February giving a speech against the drug war and was one of 38 speakers invited from around the world. And the guy from the United Nations, Antonio Mazzatelli, gets up and he says, well, we can't legalize drugs because it's going to put more drugs everywhere. It's going to be bad for the public health. I was the next speaker. I got up and walked over to his chair and I said, well, how is this Al Capone drug policy you got in place now working, where it's killed 60,000 Mexicans since Philip Calderon took office in 2006?
We got to go to a break. You make your last point, and then I'm going to get you your rebuttal, and we'll take your calls. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dupont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. James Gurek is with us this evening. He is a Democrat, but that's really not why he's here this evening. He is the Executive Board Secretary of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's a former prosecutor at Cook County, Illinois, and also he ran for state's attorney back in 1992, ran to the Democratic Party for governor in 2004, saying no more prisons. And how did you do? What place did you finish?
I was first on the ballot and didn't come in first. And it didn't matter how, but I was talking about pension reform back then. I was talking about an increase in the state income tax. I was talking about casino gambling, things which are now coming into place.
Well, you were ahead of your time. Also joining us this evening is our Republican, is Anthony Anderson. He is the chairman of the Republican Precinct Project in Illinois, which is a goal to put a Republican precinct committeeman in every precinct in the state.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And when you're not doing that, you're involved in the juvenile justice system for, what, 19-plus
yes,
years?
Yes, I worked with the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice at IYC Warrenville for the past 19 years.
And you work at a maximum security prison for
it's
women.
It's the only maximum security
juvenile,
in Illinois.
Women.
Yes, maximum security juvenile facility.
And how many inmates do you have?
Generally speaking, it ranges from anywhere between 40 to 100 on any given ruling basis.
Okay, so these are the baddest of the bad girls.
These are the baddest of the bad. I mean, you have to actually get a ticket to come here.
Wow. Also joining us is Michael Miller. He is Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University from the great city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Joins us tonight and is bringing a discussion of economics to our broader discussion of economics and drugs. And you were about to make one last point, and not – you'll make yes. other points throughout the night, but before the break, you're going
to
make
I was trying to give an illustration of how bad the war on drugs is and its consequence. And when I was in Mexico City in February and the United Nations representative, Antonio Mazzatelli, said we can't legalize drugs because it would adversely affect the public health, the second example I gave was why we had these 38 speakers from around the world in town. Mexican drug authorities seized 15 tons of methamphetamines. Now, that is a huge amount. It's probably a world supply for a couple of years. And so I asked him, how good is it for the public health when we have a prohibition policy in place that attracts 15 tons of meth in one place? You can't seize 15 tons unless something has brought the 15 tons there. And it's prohibition that is the magical economic potent pill that puts the meth.
Well, but here's my only problem with that is the fact that you're trying to compare the drug trade, the drug war with prohibition from the when they prohibited liquor sales in this country. I mean, do you honestly think that once we lift the veil of legalized drugs in this country, that all of a sudden these guys who are in street gangs, no real education, are going to all of a sudden become angels overnight? I mean, do you honestly think we're not going to need prisons anymore simply because we've ended drug trade in this country?
I think what's going to happen is when we take away the temptation for someone to see that the easy road is to go in the drug business, they're going to reconsider what they're going to
do for
a living.
Well, then the next question which begs me is, who's going to regulate the industry, this new industry that you, this new cottage industry that you have right now?
What new cottage industry?
The drugs. Who's going to regulate marijuana, heroin,
PCP, just as methane? When alcohol prohibition ended and we eliminated the national prohibition, the National Congress delegated to the states and to local municipalities the authority and control over those substances.
But you were talking about a different clientele.
Now,
it's a totally different clientele from the prohibition of the yesteryear to the prohibition of today in terms of
it
drugs.
It is people
Do
who
you honestly
it is,
think people are going to stop using drugs.
It is people who drank alcohol, and it is people who use drugs. They're the
but
same.
But they weren't
being.
Out killing one another.
They absolutely were. We had Al Capone in this town.
To the point where we at right now. Well, to the point where we at right now.
They were hanging off of Packard running boards, shooting each other with Tommy guns.
I understand that
and
whole
hanging
process.
Off of Packards. But what we have done
– relatively smooth.
Go ahead.
And it ended relatively smooth. But do you honestly think because we're going to stop letting a bunch of young kids in these inner cities from stop selling drugs that it's going to all of a sudden end crime in this country as we know it?
Let me ask you a follow-up question. Is there anything – because clearly, I mean, the incarceration rate in this country, there's over 2 million incarcerated.
2.3.
And it is the largest – we incarcerate more than any nation on earth. Mm-hmm. My question to you is, and again, many of those who are in prisons are African-American. What signal would be sent to the African-American community if drugs were legalized?
Well, like everything else, it'll be like, well, you know, I've always thought that this should be a non-criminal act, so why am I in jail now for something that's now decriminalized at this point in my life? That's what they're going to say.
Yeah, well, let them out then.
Well, let them out then. That's what they're going to say. Well, let them out.
The people
what,
who.
What is the point of the penal system at this point?
Here's the question.
To protect me from violent people. That's
exactly.
What it is.
And the people who are
violent people.
What stigma is there in the black community for being in prison?
Well, it's a bad stigma. I mean, because if people see that you're coming out of a prison type environment, the first thing they're going to think is you were a ne'er do well. That is the only reason why you were in that capacity at that time. They're not, you don't go to prison for being a good guy and following all the rules. So that's a stigma. It's a big stigma in the black community.
In Cook County, you go to prison because we arrest 23,000 people a year for minor pot violations.
And it costs
the city of Chicago.
Because you break laws.
Let me finish.
You go to prison because you break laws.
Professor,
$68 million a year it costs us to lock those people up.
Let Michael talk.
I'm astounded by that. 23,000?
23,000. That's why Tony Preckwinkle, the president of the county board, is in favor of issuing pot tickets and decriminalizing, i.e., marijuana with pot tickets. It costs $78 million a year.
Go ahead,
Anthony, you're correct that if they violated the law, then you should do something about it. But the law is speaking as one who has never once in my life had marijuana cross my lips, never once, I cannot believe that it's not legal. And the fact that we would put people in jail and pay all this money – to put people away for using something that's probably less damaging to them than alcohol is.
Here's the thing, though.
It's astounding.
Marijuana is a threshold. Marijuana today, cocaine tomorrow. Cocaine tomorrow is going to be heroin the next day.
But,
so if you get rid of these so-called nuisances like marijuana, that's only the gateway for everything else to come.
But
what do you think of?
You may think that.
What do you think of some other punishment for those who are convicted of possessing marijuana?
Well, I'm all for.
What about the concept?
I'm all
of
for
the
a lesser
ticket.
Punishment, for to a degree, for a nonviolent crime. Don't get me wrong. I don't think that people that haven't created violent acts against other individuals should be locked up per se. But to think that when marijuana and every other drug out there, like I say, I think that it's a gateway drug. It's just bound to happen that you will create another crime because of your usage from this drug, which will lead you to other drugs.
You know, in countries where they have marijuana as basically decriminalized, they have not taken these users and put them into the hands of the hardcore sellers. In the United States, when we put marijuana in the same schedule with cocaine and heroin, now somebody who's going to experiment with marijuana is at an outlet where they can also get the heroin and the cocaine. In these other countries like Holland, where you can go in Amsterdam to a coffee shop and you can buy off a menu 20 different kinds of marijuana or hashish, they haven't had anywhere near the problems that we've had because people
don't we have similar shops like that? Well, not to that extent in California.
No, we have medical. We have medical marijuana in California, but of the 17 states that have the 17 states that have approved medical marijuana is now getting resistance from the political powers, including Barack Obama, who said that he wouldn't do raids on medical marijuana facilities where the voters of a particular state had approved medical marijuana and or where the legislature has approved it. And instead, we've had more medical marijuana raids under Barack Obama than we had under Bush. And
if he understands that's the crux of the problem,
People who are sick and entitled to their medicine should have access to the medicine without turning them into criminals.
When we look at again moving to the next step, which is the incarceration, once the laws are broken, and we're talking about there's a question as to whether or not the laws should be on the books, should they be enforced? In some jurisdictions, they're enforced more aggressively than others. Some would argue they're more aggressively enforced in African-American communities. I think you might even agree with that, would you?
I agree with that to an extent.
Okay. Yeah, certainly, your
I mean,
liberal,
it doesn't happen around
liberals
me,
within the community would agree
right.
with that.
Right.
Okay. So my question would be, when you're talking about now the incarceration and you're talking about the growth of, again, the public is putting pressure allegedly on the elected officials. Mm-hmm. They then are responding. I mean, you know, giving a community a prison mm-hmm. is about as old a political payback right. as the country.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
And the road to state capitals all over the United States, including here in Illinois, is paved with prisons. Because the lawmakers from the rural areas, you know, they're driving to the state capitol and they're looking in the rearview mirror, the front mirror, and there's a prison that they brought to that district because that's the way they deal with it.
And a lot of people
view the political trade-off here is that rural politicians, wherever they're listening in the country, wherever they live in the country, their payback in the legislature of that area is they're the prisons, they're providing work for their constituents, basically to arrest and incarcerate those people from the big cities. In many cases, they're black.
Well, yeah.
Do you agree with that or not?
Well, I agree to it with an extent. The fact of the matter is you go after the people who are committing the crimes. For instance, what if a person went to your neighborhood and it was five or six kids, young kids, smoking marijuana in front of your house? What would be your natural reaction?
I think there should be a rule.
No, answer the question.
If you'll let me answer it, I will.
In front of your house, smoking marijuana, what would you do?
In my judgment,
what would you do? What would you do?
You've asked me three times, and you haven't let me answer once.
Okay. You know what? But we're going to
don't
wait
dance
right
around
now.
The you're answer the question. Dance around the idiot.
He's going to think about it for 3 minutes.
You got 3 minutes.
We got to play. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. James Garrick, you were answering the question that Anthony asked. If there were five kids smoking marijuana in front of your house, what would you do?
Well, first of all, I want to let him know where the marijuana came from. Because of Prohibition, we have 21,500 tons of marijuana manufactured a year in Mexico, and it is the largest cash crop in the United States because of Prohibition. And now, because of that, it's so available that the kids find it easier to get than alcohol or cigarettes, because they get carded if they try to get alcohol or cigarettes, but you can buy the marijuana in the park. So if these kids were out there, I think we should have a rule that says that kids aren't supposed to smoke marijuana in public, and adults shouldn't be smoking marijuana in public. But you can't put in place a rule to regulate a substance once you prohibit it.
So would you call the police or not?
I would go out and shoo the kids home and tell them under the present laws you can go to
so,
jail.
So pretty much,
well,
hey,
come on.
Hey, listen, you little a-hole. You think you're going to smoke marijuana in front of my house, bring down a property value, let the neighborhood go to waste like any other side of Chicago? Are you
right?
Serious? Get from in front of my house, and you got 1 second because I'm calling the police right now. Well, that's part and parcel of the problem in Chicago right now. If you look at the south sides of Chicago and the west sides of Chicago, the fact of the matter is you have people that don't report crimes in their neighborhood, which stems from the use or illicit use or legal use of drugs in their communities.
But the reason you have these kids out there is because somebody is trying to make money from the drugs.
All excuses. Hey, go get a job.
Michael.
Get a real job. Don't sell drugs. Do you realize that the average person selling drugs is making below minimum wage? Yeah, Are you serious? The average person is making below minimum wage, and because you say let's decriminalize and not make drugs legal in this country, we're going to let these guys just be who they are and sell drugs?
Would you answer one political question? And I'm going to ask it to you, and I want to get your answer, sure. Michael, but then I want to also get Anthony's response. When you look at the pressure to to enforce laws, the three strikes you're out law in California is one of the reasons why the state of California today is in deep fiscal doo-doo, okay? Because they began to enforce it because the public wanted it.
Right.
Okay, now the public is complaining let me just finish the point. It seems to me that when you look at this tremendous growth of the prison industrial complex, just like the military industrial complex, you have people who are prison guards like yourself or in the prison system. They may be members of AFSCME or other organizing unions around the country. They create the pressure. They lobby. The people that lobbied for the strong laws in Arizona, they were the prison lobby there. They want more work. And in a situation where many of these prisons are being privatized now, as part of the privatization agreement, you have to agree that you're going to keep the prisons filled. So that isn't based on justice.
No.
It's based on
politics.
Keep feeding the people. And my question is, does that make any fiscal sense?
It makes no fiscal sense whatsoever. And in my mind, you set up a bit of a straw man. You said there'd be five kids outside my house. Well, there wouldn't be five kids outside my house drinking beer because we've decided, even though beer is legal, we don't let children do it.
Right.
So
Or in public. You can't walk around with an open bottle.
I'm in favor of legalizing marijuana, but I.
What about all the hardcore drugs?
I'm torn there. But let's focus on. And the issue here is, if it's a legal thing to do, we can regulate it. And one thing you can regulate is you say the children can't have it. You can tax it. You can correct the quality.
It'll be marijuana today and hard drugs down line. Everything is done incremental.
Everything is done incremental.
That's just the way I look at it.
I'm not sure there's data to support that.
If we legalize drugs, would you use heroin?
Absolutely not.
Would you use cocaine?
I've used drugs a day in my life.
Would you use cocaine?
But the fact of the matter, there are individuals who have used drugs. Do you not think that
they're using them now?
Okay, let's make drugs legal, like you want to do. Let's make drugs legal. Do you realize the amount of people that are now going to start using drugs because they're legal?
You are assuming that people are going to act differently than you're going to act. The people who want to use drugs are already using the drugs, and they're uncontrolled and unregulated.
But you're assuming that everyone has led the same lifestyle that I have.
With many
people. Well, wait a minute. Anthony, are you saying...
I'm saying you have to work to be a class X in this country. You have to work to be a class X. You don't just slip into a class X felon. And that's what California.
Here's my point.
You have to work to be a class X.
How many? Let's try to put ourselves in the mind of a 16-year-old. Okay.
Which in Illinois is an adult.
Depending
on what crime.
Let me finish.
Depending on the type of crime.
Gentlemen.
16,
Anthony,
you're an adult.
Let me ask the question.
Guns, 16,
let
you're an
me
adult.
Ask
you
the
get
question.
Charged as an adult.
How many of those 15 or 16 or whatever the case may be, teenagers, how many of those teenagers, before they take their first sniff of a joint, see, I don't even know the terms. But my point is, how many of them, before they do that, say, you know what? I'm going to think about the legal consequences of this. What is it?
There's a difference between.
How many people are thinking about that?
There's a difference between usage and selling.
There's a difference between usage and selling.
Half the people in the United States have used an illicit substance during their lifetime.
Okay.
You're going to lock up half the country? What we do right now is we take these.
Whatever it takes to maintain order in this society. If that means criminalizing the usage of illicit drugs, then that's what I'll do in order to maintain order.
You have criminalized drugs, which is why we have so much violence and crime. Why the gangs around the country are out of hand.
Violence and crime is centralized in some of the poorer neighborhoods in this country, whether it's the South Side or West Side of Chicago, whether it's Watts or Compton in California, any part of New York or Florida. It's centralized. It's contained.
You're trying to overspeak me.
I'm contained in a problem.
One example. Gentlemen. We're running out of time in hour number one. We have lit a little fire here. We are going to continue this discussion. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to continue this discussion in the next hour. We'd really like you to weigh in on it. 1-800-723-8289. All of our guests will be back. And again, James Gehrig, thank you for joining us in hour number one. Michael Miller from DePaul University joins us, and also Anthony Anderson joins us as well from the juvenile justice system in Illinois, and also with the Republican Precinct Organization. We're going to pause right now. Again, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, don't go away. We'll be back for another full hour. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis. Hour number two, we welcome Republican Anthony Anderson, Democrat James Gehrig, and Michael Miller, Associate Professor at DePaul University in Chicago. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289, and we are having a spirited discussion about drug legalization in the country and our propensity to incarcerate people at a higher rate than anybody else in the world. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee, has been standing by, very patient. Let's bring him into our conversation. Go ahead, Tennessee. You're on WLS and Coast to Coast on America's great radio stations. Go ahead.
Thanks, Bruce. First, I'd like to say nobody's touched on the fact that in the inner cities, in the black communities, children are being born out of wedlock at about a 70% rate. And when that happens in society, when there's no father structure in the house, chances are that child is not going to fare very well. And I mean, I'm surprised nobody's mentioned this. And as far as the war on drugs failing, I'm sure it hasn't done too well. But neither is the war on poverty. So should we give up on that? I mean, there's just as many people, if not more people, in poverty now. After we've spent trillions of dollars, and like I said, we have in the inner city communities, a 70% rate of children being born out of wedlock.
One thing to put in context, and what you say is accurate. But again, I think we have to put it in context. When you talk about illegitimate children and children being born out of wedlock, it is not unique to the black community. If you look at rural white communities around the United States, again, the rates are staggering. The use of drugs, although people generally focus on the inner cities and talk about the use of pot and harder drugs in the African American communities, you cannot overlook meth and what meth has done and is doing literally this evening to hundreds of thousands of communities all over the United States, primarily white, not uniquely. So when we talk about the drug problem in the country, when we talk about the illegitimacy problems in the country, when we talk about the parental irresponsibility epidemic that we have in this country, it is not unique to the black community. In fact, the numbers may be even larger in the white community. But again, your point is taken, is what is happening within those communities and how are people reacting to it? If they have no parent at home, and I think this is your point, if they have no parent at home, they are less likely to be successful at school because they don't even want to go to school. If they don't do that, then they have to figure out something else to do. And absent a father or absent some program that might save them, they are likely to get hooked up into a gang, and then they are brought in to the drug culture. If not by a user, they then become part of this multi-billion-dollar business.
Oh, yeah, and Bruce, and something else. I was raised in Southern California, so I saw firsthand a lot of things. And you're right, in the white communities, it's bad, too. Like here where I live out in the country, seems like more of the young people are on prescription drugs now than, say, pot or meth. Meth was really big back here a few years ago, but now it's into prescription drugs. And you're right. I mean, there's a lot of white families here or young women that are having kids.
So what is the common denominator? It seems to me that the common denominator is escape. It's one of the same reasons why people drink. They want to escape. They want to get to a different altered state. They want to escape from where their lives have put them. Jim, you have a comment.
Yes, you mentioned the war on poverty, and you say because we're not winning that, maybe we should abandon that too. But we didn't pass a national law that endorsed poverty. We did endorse a law that put in prohibition in place. And it is because we passed that law that the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which included Kofi Annan and former Volcker of the Federal Reserve System and the presidents of other countries, they came up with a report that said over the last 10 years, worldwide drug use for opiates is up 34.5%, that cocaine use worldwide is up 27%, that pot use is up worldwide 8.5%. The war on drugs causes what we're trying to prevent. It puts more drugs uncontrolled and unregulated everywhere, whereas a licensing or a regulation system would be able to control and regulate these substances. It would be less dangerous to the user. It would be less dangerous to society. We would have less gangs, less guns, less violence, less prisons, less trade imbalance, less corruption, and less of the things that we're trying to get rid of.
I want to get Professor Miller's response. Mike, do you see it in as rosy a picture as Jim just painted?
No, I don't quite
rosy. Where do you differ from his interpretation of what could happen?
I'm convinced that if you would get rid of the profits from these drugs, then you would end up with much less, everything you said, fewer violence, you'd have less having to be paid for prisons and so forth. I mentioned earlier on that I was kind of torn when it comes to marijuana. I'm not torn at all. I see this as not something that's terribly dangerous. But you, Anthony, were mentioning about what about heroin and cocaine. I'm really kind of torn because it clearly can destroy lives.
It has destroyed lives.
But I'm not convinced that just because it would be available that somebody like me all of a sudden would have used it who didn't use it at all.
Like the caller said earlier, the caller made a good point. When you have communities, just bring up the inner city, for instance, when you have people in inner city that out of wedlock birth is at a 70% rate, you don't have two parents in a house, you have kids running around doing what they want to do, and now you're going to decriminalize and legalize the usage of drugs, certain drugs, illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. What do you think? What effect do you think that's going to have on that community? It's going to have the most negative effect this country has ever seen. I'll put it to you this way: back in the early '60s and '70s, when they were telling women who were on public aid in the black community, hey, listen, you'll get your public aid check as long as there's not a man in the house.
Right. That was
what happened then. What happened when you took that person out of that house because you want to give that person, the other person, a so-called way out?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, but see, that's the.
But what happened at that point?
Everything fell apart. It got worse.
And now we're seeing some of the same things
that's
happening.
That's the same government doing this.
With drug usage.
That's the same.
I want to keep coming back to economic issues as it relates to this. As someone, again, you are a professional in the field for 19 years. You get your paycheck because you're part of the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
Okay? And you've got a union that wants more prisons to be built. You want them to be filled because that's a job protection program. Let me finish just a minute. For you, for many African Americans in your community, right? Mm-hmm. There's a large number of African Americans who are in who are COs at prisons all over the United States, right?
Right.
So it isn't just the black inmates that are in prison. Yeah. Let me just finish my point. The cost of doing that in a world where the number of dollars are dwindling, and it gets back to a point that Jesse Jackson makes all the time, which I agree with. When you're spending that much money to incarcerate people for a variety of reasons, shouldn't you be spending more money up front on early childhood education, on education? And is every dollar not used on education a waste? I want you to think about that. And I want to get everybody's response to that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Anthony Anderson, I asked you before the break in a rather lengthy question, which you're not going to ask me to repeat.
Not at all.
Basically, the short version is, given the dwindling dollars, shouldn't those dollars go into education and prevention so that kids don't get wrapped up? If they don't have a father, they've got some program at school that's keeping them engaged so they don't fall into a life of drugs and or crime.
Well, I can certainly understand where you're coming from, Bruce, but on the other hand, I believe that you have the benefits far outweigh the risk in terms of having a strong, vibrant prison community in your country. I mean, make no mistake about it. I can also understand Jesse Jackson when he says, well, we should have a first-rate education and a second-rate prison system as opposed to having a first-rate prison system and a second-rate education. I mean, I understand all these arguments, but the fact of the matter is you have to have a place where individuals go who break the law. And if that place is jail, then so be it. If that place is at on detention with ankle braces, so be it. But you have to have an alternative, or you have to have something in place.
I want to get back to the ankle bracelets. The concept of ankle
braces. Hey, man, half of Chicago is walking around with ankle bracelets. Are you serious? Guys can't even get into airports with ankle bracelets on.
Do we have enough of them?
Obviously, we don't. I mean, we still have a bunch of lawbreakers, and they consistently.
Oh, my goodness. I keep hearing that. Lawbreakers, you're assuming, of course, that the law makes sense in the first place. That I'm a law and order guy. And as long as I know the rules.
You're a conservative Republican.
Yeah, I'm conservative.
No, I mean, for those listening around the country, you're one of the few conservative Republican professors.
Yeah, there are many of us.
He's a prosecutor.
And I'm a prosecutor. I put people in jail for murder, mm-hmm. rape, armed robbery, home invasion, gun offenses. Now we can't keep them there because you want to put these voluntary, consensual drug users
Mike
in.
I want Mike to finish his point.
I think I made a comment when we were off the air that you don't seem to have not even one libertarian bone in your body. And I guess I'm just thinking that some of these laws are just plain unnecessary. And they have unintended consequences. And clearly, you look at one of the things that when I study economic history, I used to teach it a lot, and I don't teach it as much now, we would do the economics of, say, slavery and into the black family and so forth. Up until the 1960s, the black family was an astounding institution where you had marriage rates which matched across the board in terms of white, black, and so forth. In terms of out-of-wedlock married babies, they were almost identical to the white population. And the fact that this was all done under the problems of discrimination and Jim Crow and so forth, and then the unintended consequence of the government's policy to try to give you something to give you this welfare and so forth, but as long as the father's not there. I see a strong parallel between these laws where we're thinking, oh, we've got to protect you from yourself. We've got to make sure that you don't put something into your body. And the unintended consequences of all this violence that we're getting across the country, in cities and even in rural parts where people are killing each other.
But the violence that's being perpetuated is not being perpetuated in every community the way we see it in Chicago on the south side, the west side of Chicago.
Right.
We're living in Illinois alone. We are living in probably three out of, I think the FBI did statistics, and they said Illinois, for instance, the south side of Chicago, has three or four of the most violent parts of the city in the country.
Of course, when you look at Englewood and so forth. I wish we could do some kind of an experiment, and if we would somehow not have these drug laws, and 5 years from now, would we be seeing the kind of killing that we're seeing? The black-on-black crime is just astounding, and almost invariably it is one gang against another.
Right. But your point about the unintended consequences of what some social engineers in government thought was a good idea.
It
significant ramifications, just like there were significant ramifications of prohibition.
Exactly.
Prohibition initially, I'm talking about liquor prohibition.
Right.
It came to being because they wanted to stop drunkenness. Drunkenness in the country was huge.
Yeah.
Well, did it stop drunkenness?
No.
It did stop drunkenness, but the unintended consequences of what came beyond that, which was organized crime and everything else.
Right.
Now, you during the break, you mentioned you were touting a book, not your book,
Michelle
Jim,
Alexander,
and her concept basically summarized the concept of the book because you suggested that Anthony read it. Maybe some listeners want to read it as well.
Michelle Alexander is a professor at an Ohio law school, and her thesis is that what we have done in this country, the United States, is put in place a drug prohibition paradigm, which has replaced the old rule, where we used to discriminate against people by black. We made them slaves. We took away their right to vote. We said you couldn't pass the property criteria, you couldn't read, and therefore you can't vote. Well, you can't do that in society nowadays. But what we can do is discriminate against people.
It's impossible for that to happen.
We can
now
discriminate against people if we convict them of a crime. So if we take the black people, the brown people, the minority people, and we convict them of a crime, now we can take away their right to a Pell Grant. We can take away the right to go into the military, the right to get a job. We take away the right to public housing. We take away the right to any public benefits. And so now we have taken these people and so disenfranchised them, not just with the vote, but with the economic power to live.
So that means you wouldn't qualify for a government benefit.
So we give them
that
no
means
choice.
You wouldn't qualify for a government benefit, right?
But to go into
it's a,
the
it's
drug
a government
war.
Benefit.
So it is Michelle Alexander's thesis that what we have done is supplanted the old prejudices and discrimination of old with a war on drugs as a means to criminalize and continue to keep black and minorities.
I can certainly understand what you're saying, but the fact of the matter is, it's sort of hard for me to understand when you have a black president of the United States. You had Condoleezza Rice. You have the current United States Attorney General, the chief law enforcement officer in this country is black. And then you have black caucus members. You have so many Congress members in Congress that are black that they have to have a caucus. And in the state legislature, you have blacks all throughout that have made choices and decisions in their life to take a path of say, listen, we're going to do it this way instead of the path of least resistance.
And those people are lucky and didn't get caught when they smoked.
There is no luck.
They didn't get caught when they smoked marijuana. President Obama smoked marijuana.
Are you telling me that I'm lucky because I didn't go to jail and I didn't use illicit drugs or illegal drugs?
No, I'm telling you that the people who are in these leadership positions.
The president used marijuana.
Absolutely. The president before him used marijuana, but that doesn't make it right. But the fact of the matter is, it gets hard for that argument that you're bringing up when you see blacks in position of power and authority in this country.
They're exceptions to the general rule. The general rule is
we have a whole lot of exceptions in this country.
We're going to calls. Lori, listening to us on 89 WLS. Go ahead in Chicago.
Oh, you know, just listening to this conversation, there's so many different things I could say. I am, you know, a middle-class, average housewife in Chicago. And I think the most important thing I can say is that politicians need to realize that the average middle-class voter would vote in favor of legalizing drugs in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. It is clear the gentleman who's arguing about how it's just a replacement for prohibition. I mean, to me, to my friends, to the, you know, people I talk to in the supermarket, it's just abundantly clear that it's the money it artificially creates, puts money into the hands of people who are either evil or who sucker these poor young, generally guys into being drug dealers with the promise of big money. You don't have to study. You don't have to graduate from school. You don't have to be good at anything except being sneaky and being a bully and maybe being violent. And I really wonder about all of the other members of the adult community who benefit by having these kids be stupidly duped into thinking that they're going to have some kind of life by being a drug dealer. They're getting the guns somewhere. Gun dealers someplace are making a lot of money. And I really wonder, for example, you know, talk about economic analysis of this. What would be the economic impact of all these people who do these gun dealings or who do gun sales if all of a sudden all these drug dealers and their minions didn't have the money to buy these weapons with? Just that is one example. But really my major message is this is not a political taboo anymore where everybody thinks, oh, you're going to tell everybody to go take heroin because you're legalizing drugs.
Well, I think we've seen a physical
and be encouraged to stop taking your drugs and just get the money out of it.
I think around the country in a variety of states, the pendulum has swung insofar as, you know, at least medical marijuana. That's been the first step, as you say. Maybe it's a slippery slope, but at least it indicates that there can be, and again, I don't expect that this is going to be in a presidential campaign. Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico, who favors legalization, he is running out there as an independent
libertarian.
I mean, right. they didn't let him into the Republican debates at all. But again, he's a guy who's articulated this position for a long time. Mike, did you want to bring up?
Oh, I just clearly, if we could remove the money from the drugs, these people have to earn a living somehow, and maybe then it would within the community, the culture would become. You know, education's the way. It's hard for me to see. I'm very big in education. I teach at a 4-year institution, but not everybody needs to go to college.
Right.
If they just decided finish high school and your unemployment rates will be much lower than if you don't. If you just go to a community college and learn how to weld, learn how to learn some trade,
okay.
Or if you have it, go to college. But if and that takes a lot of hard work and it takes a lot of time. But if the alternative is for me to give you a whole bunch of money to go sell drugs, take that away, and these people will make the decisions we've all made.
I'm coming from the very same environment from which you're talking about. I've lived what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I lived in those environments, and I made a personal choice, a personal decision not to become involved in illicit drugs or illegal drugs. It was a personal decision. So
was your family intact?
Yes. Let me take that back. No, my family was not intact. My mother raised us, all of us, and we lived right in the projects on the west side of Chicago.
Okay.
Henry Horner Projects, check it out, 1900
sure
West Washington,
yeah. Okay.
Right across the street from the Chicago
when
Stadium.
When we come back, I want to learn more about that story, and I also want to talk about something else. We talked about education at the beginning of one's life. If you're in prison, should you be educated there? If you don't, what happens when you get out? Back shortly. From Hanover, New Hampshire to Hampton, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Our Republican tonight is Anthony Anderson. He is coincidentally a Republican. He's the chairman of the Republican Precinct Project. He's also with the Juvenile Justice Department in the state of Illinois, where he works at a maximum security prison for young women in, where is it?
Warrenville, Illinois.
Warrenville, Illinois. And how many such facilities are there in Illinois?
In Illinois, you have 8 facilities. Not all of them are maximum, but you have 8 facilities. That's the only female juvenile facility in Illinois.
Okay. Also with us this evening is James Garrick. He is with the organization. He is the executive board secretary of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He was once upon a time a Cook County prosecutor. He ran for state's attorney in 1992 in the county of Cook, ran for governor of Illinois. And again, his life's mission in recent years has been the eradication or the legalization of marijuana. And also I want to introduce Michael Miller. He is Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University, originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're going to go to calls in just a moment. But what prompted you to get on this crusade, Jim? You were a prosecutor.
Yes, and may I say, now, I only want to legalize marijuana. I want to legalize, control, and regulate all illicit substances, not because I'm in favor of drug use, but because prohibition is the most effective way to put more of those drugs uncontrolled and unregulated everywhere. Dangerous substances, which now have the ability to kill and cause overdoses, because in prohibition, when you use drugs, you're using them in the dark with no way to know how strong they are. Or when you're really in danger.
How long were you a prosecutor?
I was a prosecutor from 1970 through 1974. I worked in the trial courts of 26 in California. I worked in the homicide unit of the Cook County Grand Jury trial courts. And I had a change of heart. I used to be the most vigorous drug prosecutor, murder prosecutor that you'd ever want to see. I got out of it and basically was a municipal attorney representing people in all types of work. And I could see that our politicians kept supporting this war on drugs. They kept saying, let's get tough, crack down, 3-time loser laws, build more prisons, let's take back our streets. And the result was we ended up with more crime, more violence, more drugs, more prisons, the inability to pay for schools. And in Chicago, in one weekend, we had a dozen kids that were killed in one weekend. And then I'd listen to the Republican and the Democratic candidate, what to do, get tough, crack down. And it didn't work. They ignored the economics of prohibition. When you turn prohibition on nationally. What you do is turn the two knobs on the tub on, and out from the faucet spews not only more drugs uncontrolled and unregulated, but guns, gangs, crime, prisons, taxes, deficits, AIDS, health care, trade imbalance, corruption, no money for schools, job programs, the funding of terrorism, the evils in our society that we're trying to combat. Now, for the first time, we've had some countries in Latin America. They just had a weekend ago the summit of the Americas, and we ended up with the sex scandal diverting the attention that should have been focused on the call for the legalization of drugs, not because the leaders of those countries in South and Central America are in favor of drugs, but because it's killing their people. In Mexico, 60,000 people have been killed since Philip Calderon became president in 2006 December. And we've got the 15 tons we talked about earlier of meth being delivered.
What is
in Guatemala, the murder rate is 10 times worse than it is in Mexico.
What are the stats about the use of drugs in Colombia and Central America and South America and Mexico?
I don't really think there's much difference now than there was before we started Plan Colombia and the United States started pouring in $400 million a year.
Are they traffickers in drugs or are they users in drugs? Because Hillary Clinton during her campaign for president said it is America. We are the growth market.
The consumers.
We are the consumers.
America is the biggest consumer of drugs in the world, and Mexico is like a transit nation, but also they're able to draw. We talked about marijuana, 21,000 tons a year they're producing, and they're using those drugs, but because of the prohibition of them. The marijuana is not going to hurt anybody. It's less harmful than a glass of wine. But when you outlaw it and you tempt people to fight over it, and the money is so huge. We in Chicago last December, 2 Decembers ago, we seized 10 carloads, 10 tons of marijuana. It's insignificant.
Now, during the break, you said something to the break, and we're going to have you put it on the air now. You said you'd be willing to do what?
I told James that, hey, listen, if you're willing to say, Anthony, just give peace a chance, let's try this out. I said, let's take one state of your choosing to put this program into effect where you say we want to legalize marijuana usage or legalize hardcore drugs, whatever it is that you want to legalize and regulate that industry. And let's see how it works. Why should every state in the union have to go under this umbrella of we're going to legalize drugs? Just blanket legalization, and we're going to take it from there.
I would be happy to have a single state be the experimental laboratory.
Okay.
But there's no reason that you couldn't use all 50 states. When they ended the national prohibition of alcohol, they said you states make your own rules. So you, the state of whatever, can still prohibit everything if you want. Or maybe you're going to only legalize wine. Or maybe you're going to legalize whiskey.
Is a halfway point here also, Jim, that instead of just going from where we are, and again, we've had decades now of cheerleading for the war on drugs.
Yes.
And I would say in the last 10 years, there's been people like yourself that have begun to question it. It's never been seriously discussed in a presidential campaign at a high level or in senatorial campaigns. I think it should be, but it isn't.
Except Ron Paul.
Dennis Kucinich, Senator Gravel. Gary Johnson. The problem is that the media gatekeepers don't let these people in to say these kinds of things.
I understand that, but you're here tonight. I'm giving you two
hours.
Yes,
which I appreciate.
So, but my question is, if it's difficult to change to the way that you would like it to change, and you just said obviously you could get a one state to try it, would another way be because I think it's important that we're tying it to the incarceration rate and the economics of our prisons, should there be lesser penalty? Could you begin this by not having mandatory minimums on certain cases? And that by doing that, people are being punished, which helps – that helps you, Anthony, because they're not going away scot-free. They are being punished. They're being punished for a lesser time. Maybe we get some more bracelets – so that they wear bracelets when they get out, so they serve some time. It's not like they're going to, a Boy Scout camp. And yet we begin the process of reducing the stigma. And the point that I made before the break, it seems to me when you look at the recidivist rate in the country in prisons, if you are not educating prisoners when they're in prison, teaching them something, even if it's vocational training, whatever it is, if you're not teaching them something, they're going to be coming back again and again. Well, and to me, that's part of the foolishness of the whole prison system.
I am in favor of lesser penalties for drug offenses. But the answer is not to find out a less expensive way to maintain a bad policy. The war on drugs is criminogenic. It causes crime. It's corruptogenic. It causes corruption. It is criminogenic and drugogenic.
But you're also political. You understand that the incremental, massive change in this country happens incrementally, not.
Well, sometimes. Prohibition ended overnight, and we took the control and we gave it to the states. We should do the same thing with drugs, and we should go back and say we're going to eliminate the UN prohibition on drugs. And we're going to eliminate the United States national prohibition on drugs, and we are going to turn over the issue of drugs to the states so the individual states can determine what drugs will be legalized, where they're going to be sold, what kind of licensing, how old you have to be to buy the drug, what kind of drug, what purity regulations there are, so that it's controlled and regulated.
Well, here's the thing I wanted to do this. Back in the early 90s, when there was the whole crack epidemic, when there was disparity between the laws, whereas a young person who had 500 grams of pure crack, pure cocaine, could get
100 to 1 was the ratio, 100 to 1 in the quantities.
Could pretty much get probation, whereas a person who had 5 grams of crack cocaine, that person had to do a minimum of 5 years mandatory in the federal system.
Right.
Now, we, up to this point, as far as I know, we've since straightened out that law. Has that law ended this whole thing in terms of whether drugs are still pervasive in our society or not, cocaine, heroin, marijuana?
Well, first of all, the margin and the difference in the penalty has been reduced.
It's been reduced,
not been
eliminated.
But
it took 15 years to get that way, and not by much.
But secondly,
but has
the
it
thing
reduced
to re-
the fact that drugs are still being sold on the streets, period.
Yes, and they always will be until it's regulated and controlled. And then it will still be sold, but it will reduce the harm that's done. It will reduce the amount of money that we fritter away on prisons.
But we still
ask you a question just on that. And by the way, you've been on this program many times over the last year, several years. And you are not – you're African-American, for those listening around the country on radio who do not know that. You are not someone who's ever been on this program who's cried race or played the race card. I'm going to give you 3 minutes to think about the answer. But as you look at how that law was changed because of political pressure, do you believe that at the initial, when that discrepancy was foisted on the legislative process and on the penal process, do you think that was racially inspired at the time? And is it overturned because of political pressure? That's the question. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Anthony, my question to you, when you look at those who supported the laws that got tough on crack cocaine, do you think that was a conspiracy because of Was it discriminatory?
I don't view it as a conspiracy. What I view it as a way to attack the problem. The problem in the black community in the late 80s and the early 90s was crack cocaine. And it was so pervasive in that community, members of the political class, black or white, doesn't make a difference, but mostly black, were saying, we need something to combat this issue in our community. These guys were pretty much terrorizing the streets of the neighborhoods, whereas the average citizen can't even walk down the street. And so, yes, if you look at it from a standpoint, who was the law cracking down on? It was, disproportionately cracking down on young black African-Americans. Yes, I do believe that. But the fact of the matter is, it was the political class that was clamoring for change.
Michael, your response?
That's what I remember as well, and I was surprised when they said that they thought this was a racist action, because it was my remembrance that the black community wanted this because it was such a scourge. I just wonder, though, you're making this idea that the neighborhoods will be bad if we because of drug users, and I understand that, but I wonder—
No, the neighborhoods are bad because of drug users.
But I wonder if it were legalized, would it be as bad? I'm not convinced.
So are you ready to make that move to the south side of Chicago, west side? Where do you want to move it?
Without legalized drugs.
Charlotte in Arlington Heights is listening to 89 WLS, and you're on Coast to Coast.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I want to look up the Illinois Family Institute. They have lots of reasons why marijuana should not be legalized. They point out that the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, the Illinois Sheriff's Associations have objections. Marijuana is not harmless. A joint can cause you to could impair your driving for 24 hours or more.
Yeah,
it slows reaction time. I'm reading. Impairs motor coordination, short-term memory, makes it difficult to perform complex tasks, interferes with spatial perception.
You don't disagree with any of what you said.
No, that's why I don't use it.
And also,
drunk driving should be prohibited and is. Driving under the influence of any substance should be prohibited and
it is.
That's not the issue. The issue is we put in place a drug policy that puts marijuana everywhere. It's easier for a kid in Illinois and across the nation to get marijuana because of prohibition than it is to get a pack of cigarettes or a six-pack of beer.
Go ahead, Charlotte.
I just think it would be more prevalent if you made it legal. It also, I forgot to mention, can cause severe anxiety, panic, paranoia, psychosis. And by the way—
Are you a conservative? You mentioned the Family Institute. Are you a conservative Republican?
I'm a parent, a middle-class housewife, so to speak, like that middle-class housewife that called before.
Okay, but would you—
And I did speak to a doctor. He said that in many people or some people, it is a gateway drug, marijuana, to heroin and cocaine. And you can always, as far as medical marijuana, you can always find a corrupt doctor who will sign a prescription for you.
And would you also agree that a beer is a gateway beverage to Skid Row?
Oh, come on now.
No, I'm serious. No. Would you?
Yeah.
I think we're speaking about different situations.
Michael, you want to comment on this?
A little marijuana is not going to do it either. Again, having not used it, I've had friends who did, and they lead perfectly normal lives. One of my favorite stories is that Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, apparently every day of his life he smoked marijuana. I don't know if he used heroin or not, but this man was extremely creative, one heck of a trumpet player and so forth, and that was just something he did, and they did it every day, and I'm not in any way pushing for that. I'm glad that my children don't use it.
It's good enough for somebody else's kids,
yeah,
not yours.
No.
Okay, I understand.
Go ahead, Charlotte.
According to the IFI, Illinois Family Institute, it has not been proven by the FDA, or they have not said that marijuana, medical marijuana, is safe or is effective. Now, why does the FDA not say that?
My understanding is that there's restrictions in using or testing this particular drug. That it's not as easy to experiment to figure out what these drugs do to people because they're illegal.
And
so we can't necessarily say whether they're going to be good or bad for. I personally have glaucoma, and luckily it's not a bad case. I just wonder if someday, if something went wrong with my glaucoma, would I be willing to use marijuana if it was going to make me feel better? And the answer is absolutely yes.
But aren't there other drugs out there to take care of the problem of that?
Yes, I hope so. I hope so.
None so well as marijuana. There's a multitude of illnesses and conditions like MS. Montel Williams uses marijuana on a daily basis because he has MS. I've met people on the speaking tour who have MS. I've met people who have tumors on their long bones. There's about 7 people left who can lawfully use marijuana in the United States because the government had a program at one time where they let people with serious medical conditions use marijuana. But because there's then a flood of applications, they said, no, we have to shut this down. Well, there's still a few people that are doing it. But I have a woman I've met on the speaking tour who had a child who was starving to death, who was 8 years old and weighed 40-some pounds. Then the doctor, the pediatrician, says the child's going to die. Mother said, let's try marijuana. Well, you can't do that. He's a minor. The mother baked the marijuana into cookies or into brownies, and the child's attitude with his autism changed. He looked at a person instead of like a chair, like at a person. And 6 months later, he weighed 80-some pounds. She says marijuana saved her son's life. There are stories like this that are repeat. The lady was on Martha Stewart. It's the Unconventional Foundation for Autism. And her name is Miyako Perez, and she'll be in town in about 2 weeks.
On that note, we are out of time for this spirited conversation. This evening, Anthony Anderson, chairman of the Republican Precinct Project and also a longtime employee of the juvenile justice system here in the state of Illinois. James Gierek is here, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. What's the website if people want to know more about what you have
just
to
put
say?
LEAP, L-E-A-P, in the browser and you will get us.
LEAP, okay, and a former Cook County prosecutor, and Michael Miller, associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Hard to get a word in edgewise this evening.
That was great.
But you added a lot to the discussion of the economics.
This
program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz, Dan Dorfman, and Khalil Palil for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.